Welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today from the Delaware Coalition Against Domestic Violence, we have its Executive Director, Sue Ryan. Sue, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Laura. I'm so happy to be here today.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. January is Stalking Awareness Month, and of course, domestic violence and abuse happens year-round. So let's get started today with a quick discussion about you. Explain the Delaware Coalition, please.
I would love to. The Delaware Coalition Against Domestic Violence is a nonprofit organization, and it's also, as its name suggests, a coalition. It's a coalition of agencies and individuals and community groups all working together to prevent and to end domestic violence. And what the coalition does is not direct service, but working with those who are engaged in direct service by offering training, outreach, public awareness, education on domestic violence so people can understand what it is and how to respond to it, and work around prevention because this is a preventable issue. And also the coalition does a lot of work around public policy and advocacy. The coalition is comprised of member organizations. We have five wonderful member organizations, including Child Inc., People's Place, the YWCA, the Delaware Center for Justice, and also the Community Legal Aid Society Incorporated, CLASI. These member organizations, along with the supporters and individuals, work together throughout the year to address domestic violence in our state.
What is the definition of domestic violence, and is it always a physical act?
That's a great question, and it's the good starting question. It's not always a physical act, but many times it is. It can be a combination of tactics. It's really behavior that's repeated, and the purpose of the behavior is to maintain power and control over another individual. So it can include physical acts or threats of physical acts. And sometimes those threats are direct, I'm going to hurt you, and sometimes they're implied, you know, the raising of a fist or a look or a movement towards someone. It can also include emotional and psychological abuse, constantly putting someone down, constantly calling them names, repeatedly implying that they're not capable of just simple tasks until you wear down their self-confidence. And it often includes financial abuse, where the offender, the abuser, is controlling the bank account and all of the expenses. And that financial abuse is one of the main reasons why people feel trapped in the relationships. So it is often a combination of behaviors. Sometimes it escalates. It starts out as emotional, psychological, and then moves to physical. Or sometimes it just starts with a physical attack or a physical threat.
But it's not just intimate partner violence that we're talking about here. This encompasses the entire family in your work?
It does encompass the entire family. It can have a profound impact, a permanent impact on children, how they see relationships, how it affects them psychologically and often physically. What the Delaware Coalition Against Domestic Violence focuses in on, though largely, is the intimate partner violence.
How would you like to talk about prevention before we get into the programming that your partners offer here? When you talk about prevention, is this talking about the woman preventing this or the man or the partner, the abusing partner, from committing this?
When I talk about prevention, I'm really talking about it at a systemic level. You know, so often when we talk about domestic violence, you'll hear people say, oh, we've always had that, we're always going to have this problem. No, this problem is rooted in some system inequities, such as sexism, how we view women, how we view relationships, gender identities, you know, the roles that we expect from men and women. It's anchored in racism, how we view people differently from ourselves. These isms are the core causes of violence in our society, including intimate partner violence. In addition, when we talk about domestic violence, many times people think of it in terms of a crime, and it is a crime, but it's also a public health issue. It's something that is affecting people's emotional health and their physical health. And there's stats from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that note that domestic violence can have long-term chronic health issues for someone who is a victim of domestic violence. And so if we see it as a public health issue in the same ways that we would see smoking or diabetes, then we're going to approach it from a different perspective. We're going to approach it from, this is something that can be prevented with education, with a new view of how we view women and how we view each other.
When you're talking about entire systems, though, you are talking about everything from media to education to, how a social agency even allocates its funding and at every level. How do you tackle something like this? And when you say it's a public health issue, do we have numbers on how prevalent it is?
It's very prevalent, Laura. The statistics nationally are 1 in 4 women, 1 in 9 men. In Delaware, very similarly, it's 1 in 4 women and 1 in 12 men are experiencing domestic violence. And you're exactly right. When we talk about prevention, it is a big issue, but it's also a long-term view. It's saying this isn't a problem between two people. This is a problem that the entire community needs to look at in how we're educating our children with regards to healthy relationships. What does it mean to be in a healthy relationship? How we are interacting with each other at work and what we expect from each other in relationships. You know, it's so funny. Marriage is often, and partnership is a very common practice for people. And we just assume that everyone knows how to do that in a healthy way. But there are lots of messages that people receive from when they're very young up to adulthood that can be very confusing. Some of these messages might have come from a family in which there was domestic violence. And so an offender grows up learning that from their own parent and thinking that this is the proper way to treat someone else. And there isn't a message that's coming from schools or from society saying, no, this isn't the right way. There's lots of messages that teens have to deal with regards to what's healthy relationship, what's not. I think as a society, you know, we have to start at a very young age and talk about equity, healthy relationships, in a way that empowers people to be in those relationships in a positive way. And Delaware has actually started some work on that. The Leanne Sorensen Act, which was adopted a few years ago, empowers schools to really create policies and practices to proactively address teen healthy relationships, to look for, you know, situations that are unhealthy and to engage in educating teens in a way that is good for them physically and emotionally.
So this is a public policy issue with you.
It is a public policy, definitely, absolutely. And it's a community issue, and of course, it's an individual issue as well.
Probably taking the conversation sideways, but I recently read an article, I can't remember where it was, it talked about, we talk about how many women are raped. We don't say how many men rape.
Yes.
It's a semantic, yes. But it does change the conversation totally. When talking about that form of violence.
Yes, it does. You know, there was some research done by Dr. Lisak, and he did research on something called, or the phrase, the undetected rapist, because Dr. Lisak realized that there are more women who are being raped than there are men who are in prison for the rape. So he wanted to know, who are these undetected rapists that are out there? And his research started in colleges and universities, and it occurred over a period of years. And he engaged in behavioral studies where he would ask young men behavioral type questions, not questions such as, have you sexually assaulted someone? Have you raped someone? But he would use the definition of sexual assault and rape, such as, have you engaged in sexual relations with someone when they didn't want to by using force or holding them down? And what he discovered through this research is that there was a very high prevalence rate of serial rapists, that there was a small number of men on college campuses who were actually committing the majority of the rapes. And in addition to the rape, they were committing horrible other crimes as well. And, you know, when he interviewed these young men, there was just a disconnect between their behavior, understanding their behavior as wrong, And, you know, rape is a devastating crime. And for the victim who's on the receiving end of that, especially at a young age, it's hard to make sense of it. It's hard to know how to respond to this. And it can have a permanent impact on someone's life. And in college campuses, again, there can be lots of messages that somehow is communicating that, you know, this type of relationship, engaging in this force of relationship is okay. And it's not okay. It's not okay. And what his research indicated is that the undetected rapist on college campuses is very similar to the rapist that we have in our mind of someone who stalks someone, you know, identifies when they're vulnerable and then attacks, you know, someone who would identify somebody maybe walking home from work and sees that they stop at this cafe and then they're walking alone and then they take advantage and they attack them. His research with the college students, the serial rapists who are in college universities, is that they would target young women who were naive, freshmen, invite them to a party, give them drinks that are loaded up with you know, drugs and things that are going to affect their ability to make decisions, and then take them to rooms in the house and then rape them. You know, and this is not a he said, she said situation or too much alcohol. This was premeditated rape by a serial rapist, and it's occurring on a college campus. And those individuals, if undetected and not held accountable, will continue to do it throughout life.
Now, here I'm going to throw another one out at you. Remember a presidential issue at one point, and we found that the definition of what was sex changes, you know, from college persons to people who were older and younger. We defined what was committing a sex act differently. So, and I'm trying to introduce it back into the household with so many words and different meanings and all of this stuff. How does someone know that there is an issue in their home? How do you define it in within a household setting?
You mean with regards to a teenager with a young person?
Or with a couple. If you've got a cohabiting couple, how do you define what is domestic abuse or a violence in there?
You know, it's a great question, Laura, because sometimes people think, well, it's obvious, but if you're on the receiving end of it, sometimes it's not, because it can often start with really controlling behavior. You know, I want to know what you were doing today and wanting to read your text, and, you know, you don't have privacy on your computer or on your phone, and jealousy, a lot of jealousy around maybe coworkers or who you're spending your time with, or, you know, accusing you of spending too much time with family and friends, and accusing you of talking about the, you know, the abuser. So it can start out with just this emotional, psychological controlling of your time and energy, and then a lot of put downs. You know, you did that wrong, you could have done this better. And really this can be very, very confusing when you're on the receiving end of it, because this is someone you're in relationship with. It's someone that you married, someone that you love, and they're treating you in this way. And many, many times women will blame themselves, and certainly the abuser is blaming the woman. And so it can be very, very confusing. And then if they talk to family and friends about this is what's going on, there's a, you know, I'm concerned. Sometimes the family and friends, because they love this person and they want to help, can be quick to say, oh, dump that person or get out of that relationship. And in the long run, that might be the solution. But really what's helpful is to say to the person, this doesn't sound healthy and you should talk to somebody, and let's connect you with somebody so that you can talk through this and find a safe way to respond. Because all the stats tell us that as people exit from domestic violence situations, that is when it can be most risky and most harmful, most deadly. So exiting from a relationship has to be done with the help of others and in a safe way. And that starts with communication.
And obviously a place that you want to start any conversation might be the Delaware Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And you can find them online at dcadv.org for Delaware Coalition Against Domestic Violence.org, DCADV.org. Sue Ryan is the executive director. We're talking to her about this, and there are hotlines as well. Obviously, if you are in a situation where you're in immediate danger, 911 is the place to go. But what should someone do if you are not sure? Or what if you're in a cultural situation where maybe women don't have the rights that we are accustomed to here? Maybe that traditionally you didn't have control over family decisions or money or access to a job, et cetera, et cetera. What are your words there for someone in these kind of situations who's not sure?
Yes. It starts with communication. And I want to share some of the hotlines. There are hotlines throughout the state. These are 24-hour domestic violence hotlines. One of them is up in Newcastle County, and it's operated by Child Inc.'s Domestic Violence Program. And that hotline number is 302-762-6110. There's also a hotline down in Kent and Sussex counties, and it's operated through People's Place. And that phone number is 302-422-8058. There is also a bilingual hotline for Spanish-speaking individuals, and that's operated through Abriendo Puertas in Sussex County. And that phone number is 302-745-9874. Talking to someone at the hotline will begin with really an assessment of whether there is an immediate risk, and then connecting to resources. And for some people, the resource that is needed right away is some type of emergency housing or shelter. But for many, many other people, it's an opportunity just to talk to a counselor or a therapist or a domestic violence advocate about what is going on, to kind of talk through their feelings and the risks that they're experiencing, and then to create an emotional and a physical safety plan so that the person doesn't feel isolated and alone, because that is one of the strategies that abusers use to isolate someone from their family, friends, and supports. So it really begins with connecting people to these types of supports. And I'll tell you, one of the prevention activities that the coalition, along with community partners like Christiana Care and Westside and others, what we are trying to develop is something called domestic violence specialized community health workers. People who would reach out into the community and address this issue from the public health concern. So making sure that people are connected to a medical home, which basically means connected to a clinic or a doctor, dealing with some of the physical issues that people are dealing with, and then also offering counseling, that emotional support. That type of outreach, I think, is really important, that type of community-based support where somebody can go and talk to someone in a confidential way about what is happening in their life and then get connected to services.
Really quickly, let's just touch upon your peer programming as well. You have workshops and conferences as well, and you're working with CLASI, et cetera. So we were looking at a lay workforce to go out there and spread this information. But you have programming, though, for peers, like people who work in emergency rooms and police officers, et cetera.
We do. We do a lot of training, a lot of technical assistance on recognizing domestic violence and responding in a trauma-informed way, in a non-judgmental way, in a way that recognizes somebody who has experienced intimate partner violence has experienced a traumatic event, and that's going to affect their emotions, their memory, their ability to communicate. And so we do a lot of training on how to respond in a healthy, best practice way. And we also do training on dealing with secondary post-traumatic stress. Because if you are one of the first responders, if you're one of the individuals who's providing support, then you need to take care of yourself as well to sustain yourself in this work.
And what about educators? Because if this is going to be a public health issue and it's going to have to be taught and practiced in school.
Absolutely. The Delaware Coalition Against Domestic Violence works in partnership with the University of Delaware and the Women's Gender Studies Department, and teaches a course. The University of Delaware actually has a DV, a domestic violence curriculum, a concentration for students who want to become advocates, who want to go into law enforcement or become attorneys, and they want to focus in on responding to domestic violence and sexual assault. So they go through a series of courses that prepare them for this field of work. And the coalition teaches a course where we address the policy and, you know, the dynamics of DV, but we also bring in people from the community who work every day responding to victims of violence so that students can learn firsthand from people who are doing the work What does this work mean, and how do you do it in an effective way?
Well, we do want to get on to January and stalking, but before we do, really quickly, though, let's go back, though, to that time that you said was the most dangerous, the decision to leave. And you work with Classy, obviously, because there will be legal battles facing this person. You have emergency resources, too. But what are the steps? How does someone make the decision to leave?
As I noted, they should do that with the support and advocacy of others, to have a plan so that before they've, and of course, as you noted in the beginning, if there is physical violence and someone is in danger of physical harm or worse, then they should call 911 immediately. If there isn't an immediate danger, then they want to have a plan. They want to consult with an advocate or counselor about, okay, if you have children, how do you protect the children? What legal documents? For many victims, they will want to get a protection from abuse order, which means you're going to go to court, you're going to work with an attorney or an advocate to help you get this order. And that order might temporarily address custody and who's going to have access to the home. And of course, it says to the offender, don't have contact and don't offend and harm this person. But a protection from abuse order is only one component of a safety plan. You know, in addition to that, you want to make arrangements for where will you be living if it's not in the home, and long-term custody relationships. And then also the separation, if there's a marriage, separation and the divorce. And always, 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 what are you doing to keep safe? And that does take us back into stalking. Stalking is one of the most prevalent strategies that is used by abusers. And January is Stalking Awareness Month. And stalking can take the form of, or it can look like many different things. Of course, it can be following someone, following them in the car, and showing up at their work, showing up where they're at. Maybe they're out with friends, showing up there. But many, many times, stalking also involves social media, you know, sending messages, downloading spyware onto someone's phone or computer, tracking them by hiding GPS devices in their car. We had... there was one case that we were aware of where the ex-husband still had a key to the car, and he accessed the car, took the dash off the car, took a Nokia phone, wired it into the radio, which was wired into the battery, put it on auto answer, and muted it, and then put the dash back on the car. He was then able to use the GPS inside that phone to track the whereabouts of his ex-wife's car, thus finding out where her new job was and showing up at her office place. So the use of technology in stalking is very prevalent. And if you suspect that somebody might be tracking you via phone or spyware, then that's probably exactly what's going on. And you want to talk to a DV advocate through one of those hotlines or through Classy.
The line between I have a follower, I have a fan, to it's creepy and now he's a stalker is very fine, isn't it?
Well, it really depends on how it makes the person who's on the receiving end feel. In Delaware, stalking is defined as repeated behavior that's targeting someone and that a reasonable person would find emotionally distressful or creates fear of physical harm. You know, you can't get into the mind of a stalker. Many times if you were to ask a stalker, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? They'll say, I love this person. They're my soulmate. We're supposed to be together. I'm trying to protect them. What matters is how is the victim feeling about this behavior? You know, it's relentless and it's freaky and it's creepy and they're afraid to leave their home and they're looking over their shoulder and they're afraid they're being tracked technologically, and very likely they are. That's what matters. If a reasonable person on the receiving end of this behavior thinks, I don't feel safe right now, or I can't even sleep well at night, then that's stalking and they want to talk to law enforcement. But I will tell you, you know, the reality between what's on the books and what happens out every day in the community can be a huge gap. You know, stalking is a crime in Delaware, but it's a misunderstood crime because people don't always recognize it, and they're not sure how to respond. One of the things that we say to stalking victims is document everything. If you're getting weird texts, if you're getting phone calls that are hanging up, if there are notes left on your car, begin to document that, because that's going to help show the pattern of behavior. It's going to help with law enforcement, and it's also going to help with safety planning.
This is a crime in Delaware, and that implies that it is not always a crime, some of the actions that would count as stalking or as a precursor to a domestic abuse situation here. It's a slippery slope where at one point it crosses a line. Are legislators amenable to your message? Do police and do the courts get where that line is, where it has become to the recipient the controlling issue, that it is affecting a reasonable person?
You know, it's a great question. It is actually a crime in all 50 states, but it's a misunderstood crime, because sometimes the tactics that are used can seem, from the outside looking in, to be romantic. Well, he just left you some flowers, or she left a note on your car saying she loves you. You know, what are you afraid of? Where's the harm here? The harm is it's unwanted, it's repeated, and it's making the person feel unsafe. And in Delaware, I think for law enforcement, it can also often start with recognizing that, hey, this is unwanted, and, you know, it's a form of harassment, it's not stopping. But then prosecuting it, frankly, can be challenging. It can be challenging because of the use of technology. Nevertheless, what we would recommend someone who's a victim of stalking to do is to talk to a lawyer, talk to an advocate, get a protection from abuse, because a violation of that can also be a violation of stalking. And then violating an order of protection is also a crime and is enforced by law enforcement.
So double whammy there.
Yes.
Now, obviously, this takes fundraising, this takes partnerships, it takes donations, and it takes volunteers, et cetera. How are you paying the bills?
Laura, it's a great question. Because it's a coalition, we have some wonderful community support. And it begins with members. Anyone in the state of Delaware can be a member of the coalition. And by being a member, you're saying, hey, I'm not okay with domestic violence and sexual assault, and my membership within this coalition is stating that. And we encourage anyone who's interested in that to go to our website at www.dcadv, that's the initials of our name, .org, and to sign up and become a member. So it starts with the individuals, but we also have wonderful corporate support in Delaware. Verizon Hopeline Foundation has been a big supporter of this issue. In October, we hold what we call a Purple Ribbon event, and it's a public awareness event, and it's also an acknowledgement of the work of all the DV advocates, law enforcement, all the first responders in the state. And Verizon Hopeline Foundation is a big supporter of that event. And we're so grateful for their acknowledgement of this work and their ongoing support. We get assistance from many of the banks, including M&T, from Highmark. There's just a wonderful, wonderful, the Delaware Refinery Company, just a long list of supporters. And we are always looking for additional support. So if you're an employee within an organization and you feel, hey, I want my organization to support this, we encourage you to talk to that corporation about becoming a supporter of the Delaware Coalition. We're also often looking for board members, people who are passionate about addressing this issue, and who might bring some particular skills. Right now, we're looking for somebody who might be really good as a finance director at the board level. So if this is something that you're interested in doing, we would love for you to reach out. You can do that again through our website. Really, to address this, we have to approach it from a community perspective. We need both individual and corporate support to make this happen.
And do you look for volunteers?
We do look for volunteers. We get some wonderful volunteers from the University of Delaware, students both in the undergrad and the graduate programs. But we also can help use volunteers, especially around some of the events that we have in October.
All right. And of course, all of this can be found at your website, correct?
That is correct.
And that is an easy one, as she said. It is the initials, Delaware Coalition Against Domestic Violence, DCADV.org. Delaware Coalition Against Domestic Violence, DCADV.org. You can find that as well as a podcast of this show at our website, mix995wjbr.com, where we will also be posting those phone numbers, the hotline line numbers as well. So look for information there as well. And here is where I say thank you very much to the Delaware Coalition Against Domestic Violence Executive Director Sue Ryan. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much, Laura. We so appreciate the support of WJBR and the opportunity to talk about this very important issue.
I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.